Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. We are joined in the studio today by Brenda Siegel. She's the Democratic nominee for governor. Siegel was born and raised in Vermont. She's a housing activist and an outspoken advocate around addressing Vermont's opioid crisis. She also has taught classes in local schools on leadership, social justice, and the arts. This is her second run for governor. Brenda Siegel, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd love to start first with the beginning of your story. Where did you grow up? What was young Brenda Siegel like?
I grew up in Brattleboro, and I grew up in a family just in near downtown Brattleboro, and with two siblings, with two brothers, and I went to the local public school, Green Street School. I graduated from Brattleboro Union High School and the Wyndham Regional Career Center. I was a competitive figure skater and always really engaged in politics and my community throughout my childhood.
And when did you first start getting involved in politics and advocacy work? Was there like a moment or an experience?
I was always very interested, but in my 20s, I interned for Bernie Sanders in D.C. At the same time, I was choreographing for the Baltimore Children's Theater, and I was doing that work simultaneously. That work was really important and impactful to me. I had been sent frequently while in his office to learn about Reach Up and EBT, food stamps, and issues around poverty. But at that time, I couldn't see myself entering any kind of financial struggle. It was later when I became a single mom and not too long after that I realized that the people that Bernie Sanders was fighting for were me.
Now, you haven't held political office before, but on your campaign website and in conversations like this one, you emphasize that you've gained experience as a leader, not just through your work, but through your experience as a single mother and as a small business owner. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit specifically about your business, because I haven't heard too much about that before, and how to make you a good governor.
Sure. Well, I am a small business owner like everyone else that is a small business owner. Mine was around the arts. I ran a pre-professional training program for modern dancers, and also we worked on arts administration along those lines. At the same time as I've been doing all that, I've also been an advocate on housing and drug policy, working directly with legislators both here in Vermont and across the country to make sure that we're moving forward on issues that are really strong.
Now, you have talked in the past about structural obstacles in our state that have kept people from the quote-unquote margins of society from engaging in the political process or for running for major political office. Could you talk more about some of those obstacles and how you've been able to overcome them?
So in some ways, I have not been able to overcome them. If you want to run for select board, we often talk about this ladder. I say that that ladder has rotten rungs and it's rickety because if people run for the select board in their local communities or school board in their local communities, they often don't come sometimes with any pay or with childcare. So if you're a parent, if you're a single mom, primarily women really are going to struggle to take on those roles. To join the legislature, it is very low pay, and you would have to leave your family for a period of time throughout the year. Because it's a part-time legislature, they wouldn't be able to go to school elsewhere if you were serving in that community, especially if you're from southern Vermont, as I am. And if you're a single mom or the only parent of your child, then it's absolutely a non-starter for you to do that work. What I have done instead is I've been able to build those leadership skills and my knowledge of what we do in our political system by advocating in those same settings. I sit in committee rooms in the legislature and do my work, my remote work, while I'm also advocating on drug policy and housing work and housing, the housing crisis, and also the same is true in our local select boards, that I'll sit in those rooms while doing my work and also being able to advocate on issues like the bag ban that eventually got adopted statewide.
Well, in just a moment, I do want to transition into talking about your policy priorities and those issues that you care about so deeply. But first, I do want to linger here for a moment on this topic of experience, because ahead of today's show, when we asked for questions for you and for your campaign, we did receive some questions from listeners about your lack of political experience and, you know, going from being an activist and an advocate and a small business owner to, you know, potentially holding one of the highest positions in the state. We received a message from Sarah on Twitter who says, I would like to know why Brenda Siegel has had no experience in the legislature or city council, but wants to do the state's top job. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more and address those concerns that some folks might have.
Yeah, as I said, I've been working on advocacy inside the legislature. So I spend quite a bit of time each year, and usually much of the legislative session, if not all, in committee rooms, working directly with legislators, supporting them and working with them on introducing legislation, and following it through the entire process, including testifying on those bills. In addition to that, I've had the opportunity to work with the administration on certain issues. I'm on the GA Working Group, which is the working group around emergency housing, and I'm on the Public Transit Advisory Commission working on public transportation. I have a really robust knowledge of what's happening in the administrative role as well as what's happening in the legislature. The only thing that I have not been able to do in the legislature is vote.
Let's go to the phones now. We have a call from Stephen in Stratford. Stephen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Would you support a constitutional amendment in Vermont giving the earth rights, the rights of nature? If corporations are people, the earth should be considered a person and should have the same rights. And that has happened in other countries, and in rivers have been designated.
Well, thank you for your question, Stephen.
I'd have to learn more about what that looks like, because that's the first time I've ever been asked that question. And so it's something that I'm really interested in. And I would hope that you would email us at info@brendaforvermont.com and give us a little more information. But that said, we are not prioritizing climate change the way that we need to in this state. That means that we need to make sure that we are moving forward towards not only our 2030 goals, but also our 2050 goals, and really more aggressively right now. Well, and so I would say that while I don't know enough about that amendment to say one way or the other, what I do know is that right now we are not on track to reach our climate goals. And part of that reason is because we are not prioritizing exactly what I'm sure that the spirit of that amendment is.
Well, let's talk a bit more about climate here. Now, a major piece of legislation, the Clean Heat Standard, fell apart in the last session after Governor Scott vetoed it, and then legislators couldn't muster the votes to override that veto. Now, you have criticized Governor Scott for that veto and for governing by veto, as you've said in the past. It is possible that a version of the Clean Heat Standard will come back on the table in the near future. Would you support that? And if so, why?
Yes, I supported the Clean Heat Standard. I was really disappointed to see it fail by one vote when the veto override. What was really concerning to me about that veto was that the governor's advisors told him that his concerns had not been addressed and did not explain the legislation to him. In fact, the legislature had worked really hard to address the concerns that they were told about. And so because the advisors gave the governor the wrong information and he had those advisors surrounding him, we all don't benefit from that legislation as quickly, and it makes it harder for us to get those 2030 goals. But also, I think it's really important that this highlights the need to have climate scientists as part of your administration. It's essential if we want to meet our climate goals, if we want to make sure that we increase public transportation, that we support our small farms in transitioning to carbon sequestration and require our large farms to do the same. If we want to make sure that low and moderate income families, because our state is mostly made up of low and moderate income families, if we want to make sure that they can access things like electric vehicles and heat pumps and solar panels, then we need to make sure that we have the right people advising in the administration.
Now, one more question here on climate initiatives for you. Now, beyond heating, another major source of Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector. And there was this proposed transportation climate initiative that would have worked to address this regionally in New England, but Governor Scott and other New England governors essentially abandoned the plan before it could advance. How would you approach the challenge of reducing emissions from the transportation sector? And I'm curious to hear both statewide and regionally.
Yeah, so there are lots of issues where if we built coalitions with the states around us, and the Transportation Climate Initiative was one of those ways to do that, where we would be able to move forward. We're going to have some new governors in our local New England governors, and that's who I would be joining, and we would be able to build that coalition on the Transportation Climate Initiative. As I said, I'm on the Public Transit Advisory Commission, and I've had a front row seat to what we have been doing and what we could do to move Vermont a little more forward on this issue. What makes public transit so important is not only climate, but also it reaches both our low-income families who are often isolated and our aging population who is often isolated in rural communities. And so it's incredibly important work for us to do, both to meet our climate goals and to meet the needs of Vermonters.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Andy in Pulteney. Andy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a comment for the candidate as a farmer. I think it's very important for the government to be very, very careful about becoming involved with farming and regulating farming. I understand there are things that need to change. I think any farmer will tell you they're always open to finding better ways to doing things. But the best example of this right now is in the Netherlands, where Dutch farmers, some of the most efficient farmers in the world, mind you, second largest agricultural exporter in the world is the Netherlands, are in protest right now because of government overreach. And if we get if we regulate farmers too much, we're going to create a definite apocalypse, avoiding a maybe apocalypse.
And Andy, I just want to jump in here. Do you have a specific concern about what type of government regulation you think could hurt the agriculture business here in Vermont? Because I'd love to have Brenda Siegel be able to address that.
Yes, please. Well, I mean, in my personal experience, the diesel engine regulations has been a real problem for farmers. A lot of it has moved to computerization with the diesel emissions software, basically making us unable to fix our own equipment. And that's part of our self-reliance. You know, the margins are already tight enough. Now, I can't speak for the rest of society, but I can speak for farming, and that with the margins being as tight as they are, any little thing makes a big difference at the end of the year.
Well, thank you for your call, Andy. Brenda Siegel, I'd love to hear your response to those concerns that Andy's raising.
In my administration, we will have everyone at the table, and that means that farmers will be able to come to the table and have this conversation so that we're sure that we're both supporting what we have to do to move forward on our climate goals and supporting small farms, again, in transitioning to carbon sequestration, but also hearing from farms to make sure that we don't harm them along the way. We're a farming state. We have a lot of farmers, and we want to make sure that we're both supporting all Vermonters and protecting our ability to be a self-sustainable state.
Thank you. Well, I want to return to one of the topics that we were just touching on at the beginning of our conversation, which was some of the differences that you have on policy with Governor Scott and some of the criticisms that you've made about how he has worked to support particularly low-income Vermonters. So let's talk here for a moment about housing, because I know it's a major priority of yours. Now, you have said that Governor Scott has stated that housing is one of his main priorities as well. He's funneled a lot of money towards supporting affordable housing initiatives, but you've said that is not enough. Can you talk a bit about how your funding priorities would be different than what he has already shown support for?
Yeah, we can't just throw money at the problem. We have to have a really strong and concrete plan, and that plan has to make sure that it addresses emergency, transitional, and permanent housing. And we have to have a short-term version of that plan and a long-term version. Because right now, we don't have the housing to meet need in this state. And if we don't come up with a long-term strategic investment in housing, then we're going to just keep watching this crisis barrel out of control. And I want to add that just over 2 weeks ago, on August 31st, the governor announced that he would be ending a program where people were promised 15 to 18 months in VRAP, which is Vermont Rental Assistance Program. And that is going to touch 8,411 families who will lose their voucher entirely by December 1st, which is the middle of the winter. And these are families that may very well end up in an eviction process in a state that has just over 2% of a vacancy rate, and in some parts of our state under 1%. And those folks will have nowhere to go. And that happened without a plan for what we're going to do with the 8,411 families who completely lose their voucher, and then another 4,000 who lose a portion of their voucher.
Right. And I should note, too, that tomorrow on Vermont Edition, our show is going to be focused on that exact program, Vermont Emergency Rental Assistance. But, you know, Scott has said that, you know, this program was always designed to be a temporary emergency program to address specific pandemic-related issues when a lot of people were unemployed and really struggling to pay rent. And now the conditions have changed. And again, it was always supposed to be temporary. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, that's a bit of smoke and mirrors, because the reality is that we were told during the legislative session, I'm on the GA working group again, so we were told that and landlords were told, and the people renting were told that they would have 15 to 18 months in these programs. And when we all agreed that the transitional housing program for the people who are using the hotels as transitional housing, that we switched from GA, expanded GA program, which is the general assistance program, to transitional, that would last for 15 to 18 months. And families were also told that. But now that is ending in the end of September with less than 30 days notice. And VRAP is beginning to be rolled back with less than 30 days notice for most tenants and most landlords. And so that's extremely important to understand, is that a promise was made to families and to landlords, and we did not come up with a plan. In 2.5 years, we didn't come up with a plan to make sure these folks get to transition into a stable, permanent housing. And I want to add one thing to that. They are saying, the administration is saying, that they just didn't have these statistics written down. They just didn't know how much they were spending. I don't know how you are a government and you don't have a good record of how much you are spending.
Sorry, who was saying that?
It's quoted in several articles,
okay,
from the administration, that they said that they just don't have it written down.
Okay.
And they just didn't have it written down, and they just didn't know how much they were spending. Mm-hmm. That is direct quotes. And I believe there's in 7 days you can find it. I also believe in Digger's article on the 31st you can find it. And that is unbelievable to me. And when you pair that with the debacle that happened with unemployment, and you pair that with all this money being allocated to give bonuses to childcare professionals and that money not reaching those childcare professionals yet, you have to ask yourself, what is happening that there is so much disorganization within the administration that these mistakes keep happening?
Mm-hmm. And I think there you're referencing an article by 7 Days reporter Allison Novak about I think it was $7 million
yes,
that's been advocated or allocated for childcare workers as retention bonuses that hasn't yet materialized.
Yes.
Brenda, a central pillar of your campaign has been addressing the opioid epidemic in Vermont. And both your brother and your nephew passed away from heroin overdoses. And first, I'd just like to say I'm so terribly sorry. And when we discuss this further, if you're comfortable, I'd love to hear more about them as well. But losing a loved one to overdose is unfortunately an experience that many, many Vermonters share with you. So I'm wondering if you could talk us through the main bullet points for your plan to address this crisis, which has seemed to be worsening in recent years.
Sure. You know, we have to focus on harm reduction first, treatment and recovery on demand, including medically assisted treatment on demand, dual diagnosis support, and criminal justice reform. There is really clear science and data out there that updates how we should be handling the overdose crisis. And when we are in a state where in 2020 we saw the most increase, the highest increase in overdose deaths in the entire country, and by a lot here in Vermont, and in 2021 that we had the most overdose deaths in the history of our state. And so it's essential that we actually update the way that we think about the overdose crisis, that we put harm reduction front and center, that we expand our access to treatment, because I think folks in rural communities and all over the state know that there is not the access to treatment everywhere that there is, for example, here in Chittenden County, and that we need to make sure that we do the work that is necessary and that the science drives us to work on this crisis.
Now, as of June, Vermont has seen just under 100 opioid-related overdose deaths, which is higher than that same time in previous years. And last year, the state saw 217 opioid overdose deaths, which is by far the largest number. How much do you think the pandemic and related isolation played into that trend? And how much do we need to lay, you know, at the feet of politicians who haven't done enough to address it?
Well, we have been moving in the wrong direction for a long time. So when we didn't have these, people have been saying for a long time, for example, the hub and spoke model, while it reaches 3 in 10 from people with substance use disorder, we need to figure out what to do to reach the other 7. And this year, the legislature passed 3 very good bills that would have supported the overdose crisis, the largest being the overdose crisis response bill. And the governor vetoed all 3 of those bills and because there were studies in them that he didn't like. And I have a real problem with us not wanting to learn about the issue, nonetheless fix it. When you bury a family member, as my family has twice, there is nothing quite like it. Many of us know, many families across the state know what it's like to lose one family member like we did my brother, and then 20 years later, his son or their children. That's something that's not so uncommon, unfortunately, and that's because there is intergenerational trauma, and trauma and mental illness is the number one indicator for substance use disorder. So we have a bombarding problem where we haven't actually addressed mental health, where we haven't actually addressed trauma, we aren't putting the necessary funding into it, and then we're not putting the things that keep people alive, like harm reduction, front and center, before and treatment access, front and center. Those are the things that need to be front and center if we want to address this crisis.
Now, and I know you've also criticized Governor Scott for opposing things like safe injection sites. Do you think that those are a key element of this fight, or are there? It sounds like there are other priorities ahead of those.
There are many prongs to address the overdose crisis. You have to look at how you work on harm reduction and the overdose prevention sites. There's, again, really good research that says that not a single person has ever died in one, and many lives have been saved. Those are people that are making connections to care providers that can help them find recovery. You have to be able to make those connections, because we know that recovery comes with connection.
Now, you know, oftentimes some of the people who are at the forefront of the response to opioid overdoses are members of the police. We received a question from Jimmy on Twitter who asks, how can Brenda Siegel's policy improve the quality of life for police officers? I wonder if you could respond to that.
You know, I have found that, for example, in Brattleboro, our police chief, Norma Hardy, has done some really good work around community policing and working with the NAACP, working with community members, working with the select board to really create a mutual respect between the community and the police. And I think that's something that can happen. But we also have to fund police to do what they do, but also fund mental health professionals to do what they do, and social workers and substance use treatment providers to do what they do. And we have to make sure that our communities are whole. We can't, if you want to address this crisis, we have to make sure all along, including from police to our communities, people are cared for.
Now, when you ran for lieutenant governor in 2020, you spoke with my colleague, Vermont Public's Mitch Wertlieb, about the social justice protests that were going on at the time, including major Black Lives Matter demonstrations that were happening across the country. And at the time that you told Mitch Wertlieb, and I'm quoting here, "I do believe in defunding the police, but people don't always understand exactly what that means." Now, 2 years have passed since you had that discussion with him, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about what you meant then and perhaps now about how we fund public safety and social services in the state.
Again, I think that we have to fund police to do what police do, but we also have to fund mental health professionals and the mental health workforce to do what they do. And we have to fund our communities to have what they need so that people are not struggling or suffering. It doesn't support police or anyone else if we don't have the treatment access or housing or the care in our communities that is needed. And so all of that work needs to be done. And I really do think there is a study between what is happening in Brattleboro with a mutual respect and in Burlington where there really is headbutting happening right now. And some of that is coming from the police force in Burlington. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe trying to sit down at the table and have a different conversation is extremely important, and learning a little bit from what Norma Hardy is doing, from Chief Hardy is doing.
Well, we're joined today by Democratic nominee for Governor Brenda Siegel. If you have questions for her, give us a call, 800-639-2211. And we just received an email from Aviv a tweet from Aviv, who asks a question about teacher retention. A new topic here, shifting tacks a little bit. And Aviv asks, in regards to widespread teacher shortages, what are Brenda Siegel's thoughts about how to better incentivize teaching as a profession in Vermont, particularly in terms of compensation? Brenda.
So I just want to start by saying that our teachers and our state employees, for that matter, have been under constant attack under this current administration in the last 6 years. And that is not something that makes you want to stay in the job that you're in. To constantly hear from the governor that your pension doesn't matter, that maybe I'm going to veto the budget, which will then impact you and your ability to survive here in our state. Those things are not acceptable. And so the first thing that we're going to have to do is say loud and clear that pensions are a promise and that we are going to do what it takes to make sure that we fulfill that promise. In addition, we need to make sure that people have mandatory paid family and medical leave, that they have appropriate health care that includes dental and vision and hearing, that we make sure that those folks that are teaching our children have what they need in their classroom and that the classrooms are funded. We have to stop pitting childcare, early childhood, against public education because those are the same children. They are the same parents. They have to go through both stages of care. And so that's a lot of the work that needs to be done. But there's another piece that we can do, which is we can change from paying residential property tax towards education to a progressive income tax towards education. That will make it more possible to have more folks buy homes in our state, which also will help people to come here and work. Because one of the problems with teacher retention and one of the problems with getting people to come here and work is that there is nowhere for them to live. And so this is some of the work that we have to do here. And, you know, when you look at what teachers are actually paid in our state, there's a lot, people have a lot to say about that. But the reality is that they are not paid commensurate with the work that they have to do across the state. And that's something that we need to, these are people that are raising our children. They are another adult in our child's life. And in the end, they are the future of our state.
Well, changing the way that we fund education in the state, as you obviously know, that's a huge structural shift. Did you think that's something that is feasible in the next 2, 4, 10 years?
Yes, I think that there's a lot of support for it in the legislature. I think with a new person in the governor's office, we will be able to do it.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Michael in Waitsfield. Michael, you're on the air. What's your question for Brenda Siegel?
Hi. My question refers to people who are not exactly, to save their money, they're not poor, they're older, they've been living in Vermont for 40 and 50 years, and their houses are inadequate, insulated, the windows aren't the right windows anymore, and the roofs are not the right roofs, and their heating systems, forget about it, those heating systems are from 1971, and they're no good. And they all feel, the people I speak to, that Efficiency Vermont is an advocate for selling modern appliances and getting jobs for installers. They need an advocate for somebody that's looking out, comes to their house, tells them what they need, and is going to shop for it and buy it at the cheapest price. And they don't, nobody feels that Efficiency Vermont does that. They say they work for the, their object is something different, is not really in their favor. And
I want to jump in here, Michael, because I'm hearing a concern in there about weatherizing homes and particularly helping older Vermonters be a part of that process. Brenda Siegel, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've actually thought about this issue quite a lot. I'm on the board of Community Vermont Elders, and so I hear a lot about these same issues, that people do not have the support they need in updating their homes and making sure that their homes are safe and cared for. This is something that we need to work on in Vermont. We have the fastest growing population in our state is the aging population, and we aren't getting them the care they need, whether it is updating their homes, whether it is making sure they have long-term care providers and making sure that there is no abuse in those facilities, and ensuring that the facilities that are doing this work and the memory care facilities have the support that they need to make sure that folks can make that transition. And so the work that we really need to do is a full breadth of work around aging, our aging population. We can't just say that we support the aging population without making these changes. And yes, it's not just the low-income aging population. It really is a broad spectrum of folks that need support and help in order to make these changes.
Well, speaking of support and help, we received an email from somebody named Bradley who asks if you are getting the support you think you need from the Democratic Party in order to win this election in November. Bradley also asks, what is her message to party leadership who seem, in his words, tepid on trying to defeat the incumbent Republican governor?
Well, I'll start with the last part, which is that I have the endorsement of all the leaders in the party, and they have been really supportive and helpful, getting me to every event that they have, and making sure that that there is space for me to speak and getting my name out there with the whole slate. In addition, I am getting the support and help from the party, and it's a really heavy lift, and we're all lifting together. But we also need the support and help of the communities around us. It isn't going to be just myself and the party or others. It's going to have to be all of us together to make this change, and I'm counting on all of you Vermonters to do that with me.
Lastly, we also received a question on Twitter from Colin, who asked, what lessons, if any, did you take from David Zuckerman's 2020 run against Scott, or just your previous runs as well? What has changed in the intervening years?
You know, I'm not David Zuckerman, and this is not 2020. And so we're in a very different time. Right now, we're seeing in Vermont, Vermonters have to ask themselves, what has my life gotten better in the last 6 years? Was it even better before the pandemic? Or was Vermont getting more unaffordable? Were we losing our housing options already? We have to remember that while COVID was a crisis that we all experienced, there was already a housing crisis, there was already an overdose crisis, there was already a mental health crisis, there was already a climate crisis, and we need leadership on those issues. And what I've learned in my campaigns is that Vermonters want to see us make progress, and this is our moment for change, and we're seeing that all across the ballot.
Well, Brenda Siegel, Democratic nominee for Vermont governor, thank you so much for your time today and for coming back on Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll let our listeners know that we will be hosting a debate between Brenda Siegel and Governor Phil Scott in October, so stay tuned for that.